This podcast of To the Point is a production of KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com. Support for KCRW podcasts comes from the Southern California Lexus dealers.
From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
Have we abandoned the folks devastated by Katrina? I'm Diana Nyad, sitting in for Warren Olney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. Today on the show, it's Thanksgiving week, yet thousands of New Orleans and Gulf Coast former and current residents are asking themselves just what they have to be thankful for, nearly 3 months after Katrina pounded their cities. Bodies are still being discovered. Electricity and gas are nowhere near fully restored. Many in the bayou are feeling helpless and hopeless. On Reporter's Notebook later on, Israel's Prime Minister Ariel Sharon today announces that he will quit the governing Likud party and form a new party with the goal of winning re-election. First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
I'm Diana Nyad, sitting in for Warren Olney, back with To the Point from PRI. Katrina roared onto land out of the Gulf of Mexico on August 29th, but almost 3 months later, the devastation she left in her wake still holds thousands in dire circumstances. With so many citizens of New Orleans living elsewhere, the city has few resources to rebuild. Given vulnerable geography and suspect levees, should New Orleans be rebuilt? Now that the cameras are no longer chronicling the daily crisis, is there a sense that we've forgotten those trying to start over along the Gulf Coast? On Reporter's Notebook a bit later, popular Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon quits the Likud party, which he helped to found, and reaches out to allies to form a new party. First, this news. General Motors has announced today its plan to cut 30,000 jobs and close 9 North American facilities in the next 3 years. In the first 9 months of this year alone, GM lost close to $4 billion. The chairman and CEO of the world's largest automaker, GM, Rick Wagner, made this statement this morning.
The decisions we're announcing today were very difficult to reach because of their impact on our employees and the communities where we live and work. But these actions are necessary for General Motors to get its cost in line with our major global competitors. In short, they're an essential part of our plan to return our North American operations to profitability as soon as possible.
We welcome now to the Point Daniel Howes, who's the business columnist with the Detroit News. Mr. Howes, thanks for being with us, first of all.
My pleasure.
You've covered the auto industry for many, many years now, and GM, so much the cornerstone, really, of corporate America. It must be emotional, really hurtful to GM's pride in general to make this announcement.
Terribly so. I think it is both for the hourly workers who are scared and probably a little angry and feel as though they just came to work and did their jobs, and decisions made by executives kind of got them to this point. But also, I think for executives, there's a lot of pride inside General Motors. They talk about having been the world's largest automaker for about 73, 74 years, and always thought that that would continue. And to basically acknowledge that that's no longer going to be the case, particularly in the United States, they're effectively saying we're not going to control a third of the market anymore. We're going to go down to maybe a quarter of the market in the United States, which is a huge drop in the car business.
Enormous. Let's analyze a little bit about, you know, just what got General Motors into this predicament. I know that the sport utility vehicle has sagged rather desperately the last couple of years, yeah?
Well, that's part of it, but I don't think you should overplay that. I mean, the SUV sales have softened a little bit, but GM still controls about 50-60% of that market, and frankly is doubling down on its bet and thinks that it's going to continue to do well. Same thing for large pickup trucks. But the other more untold story of GM, I think, is that they are very aggressive in the car side of the business and are building some pretty good cars that are getting very high marks. Certainly the renaissance of their Cadillac brand mm-hmm. is probably one of the best stories to come out of Detroit from a product perspective in 20-plus years.
So if the product has improved and you know, as you say, Cadillac has gotten a lot of play, you know, is it the marketing?
That's part of it. I also think it's the market. I think a lot of Americans have had their experiences with Detroit products and GM products in particular, and have said, you know, I don't know that I want to give it another shot. I'm happy with my Toyota, my Honda, my Nissan, whatever it may be. And I think that, for me, that's one of the scariest parts about this. I mean, I think General Motors is doing better from a product perspective. They got a long way to go. Don't misunderstand me. But they're doing a lot better. But if consumers don't give them another shot, if they don't get into the cars, drive them, experience them, no matter what GM does, it's not going to totally turn itself around. They cannot cut themselves to prosperity.
Sure. I remember back at the end of the summer, huge headlines in terms of pension, health care costs, not just with GM, but, you know, with other automakers. But that has crippled the company as well.
Yeah, and that will continue to be a major burden. It's very important to note that Wagner said today, again, that they were going to increase their spending on new cars and trucks by about $1 billion next year, from $7 billion to $8 billion. Now, to put that in perspective for your listeners, at the same time, they're going to spend somewhere between more than $5 billion just for health care for active employees and retirees alone. It is a huge burden, and it is one that is growing with each year. And then add on top of it their pension obligations. I don't think anybody at the company is saying that they want to walk away from those obligations. They know that they're contractually bound by them. But any way you cut it, it is a burden that their foreign-owned competition basically doesn't have to shoulder.
But now as they head into 30,000 jobs cut in 3 years, there will be 30,000 pensions to be paid, no?
Yeah, but those are pensions that they would have to pay anyway. I mean, those are an obligation that they have whether they're an active employee or whether they're a retiree. Yes, that's true. But I think the other thing they'd like to do is be able to get some of these people off of the payroll, frankly. General Motors has about somewhere in the neighborhood of 30,000 people who are eligible for retirement today. And that doesn't mean they want to retire. They may be, if they hired in at 20, they're 50 years old, and they may have two kids in college, and they need to work, and they don't want to retire.
Sure, sure. So better they should pay the pension and have them retire than have them still on the payroll.
Right, and that's how the math works.
All right. Mr. House, Daniel House, business columnist with the Detroit News, thanks very much for your time.
My pleasure.
I'll be back in just a moment with more of To the Point from PRI.
To the Point thanks Factiva, a Dow Jones and Reuters company, for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 8,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
I'm Diana Nyad, sitting in for Warren Olney, back with To the Point. We're just a week shy of the three-month mark since Hurricane Katrina tore along the Gulf Coast and through the city of New Orleans. As of August 28th, the day before the storm struck, the population of New Orleans was just under 500,000. Today, some 60,000 people only are living there. Nighttime winter temperatures in the 30s are making for hardships for half the current residents, still without natural gas for heat. Toilets in half the homes are still not connected to the city sewer system. And for those bunking in hotels on FEMA's dime across the country, time is running short for them, as FEMA will cut that support on December 1st. Have we all but forgotten the plight of those whose lives have been literally torn apart since Katrina hit? Joining us now from FEMA, a spokesman in Baton Rouge, is James McIntyre. Mr. McIntyre, thank you for being with us.
You're welcome.
Let's talk about this December 1st date. I mean, it's nothing emotional, to be sure. It's an understatement that FEMA is absolutely overextended, has paid, the way I understand it, some $275 million already for hotel rooms. But what can be done for the people who just can't get back into town yet, have no funds themselves after December 1st, which is coming up real quickly?
First, let me clarify that
okay.
At this FEMA is not kicking anyone out of hotels. What we are doing is we are stopping a program that provides direct funding to the hotels. We work with each of the applicants, and if they have registered with FEMA, most of them had received at least two forms of assistance, either cash assistance under the Transitional Housing Program, or they received the $2,000 for those that were in certain parishes or counties within the affected areas. What we are doing now is FEMA will no longer fund that program after November 30th. For those people who want to remain in the hotels, they can use the rental assistance that FEMA has provided them to continue to stay in that hotel, but they will be paying for it using the assistance that's been provided.
Okay, understand. Well, that's some solace. I'm not sure that the mass public out there, even the people in the hotels, understand that. How does FEMA get the word to all these people? It must be very difficult just to communicate day by day with people in these dire circumstances.
What we've started in Louisiana and areas in around the country are beginning to start is an outreach program. We actually have FEMA people that are going door to door to the hotels in Louisiana, talking to the evacuees, finding out from the evacuees what their plans are to seek shorter-term housing solutions, or longer-term housing solutions, rather, and then working with them, telling them what options are available from federal and state assistance, as well if for some reason, if people don't qualify for FEMA assistance, what HUD can provide or what volunteer agencies can provide. But we're working with them to help them understand how they can maximize their dollars that they receive from FEMA under rental assistance and use it to find better housing solutions for their families.
Okay. Let's talk about FEMA's problems right now as well. We mentioned before just absolutely tapped out financially. How are you doing in terms of more government assistance for you?
We're fine. We work from the Disaster Relief Fund, and we depend on Congress to appropriate dollars to those funds. As we use the fund, Congress sees the needs and reappropriates funding to the Disaster Relief Fund.
All right. I wonder if you would, Mr. McIntyre, stay with us a bit. We want to talk to a couple of people who are rebuilding their lives, their homes in the area, and maybe you could come in and join the conversation once we get going with them.
Okay.
I sure appreciate it. First is Wallace Windsor. We actually spoke with Ms. Windsor back in August when she had evacuated her home. She was boarding a few students at Tulane University and now has come back to her home and is making her way. Ms. Windsor, how are you?
I'm fine, thank you. How are you?
Well, I'm okay. First of all, you know, as I remember, you went with these kids. You drove out in a hurry. Did they ever come back to go to school? Did they go back to Europe?
No, they're actually in different locations in the United States, Baltimore, Texas, and New York.
Oh, so they didn't come back to go to school there, though?
No, there's no place for them to live.
All right. And how about you? You came back home, and you have seen what?
A half-demolished house. there was about 5 feet of water in my house, but it is salvageable, but I'm still not living there.
Oh, I guess you can't. Is mold the huge issue? And did you actually, you know, lose property itself?
Yes, actually I did. Mold was a very big issue. Most of it's gone now, but I'm keeping my eye on it. It's going to be probably 3 months before that is rebuilt.
And literally, what do you have to do? Do you have to replace floorboards? Do you have to raise the house? You know, what's going on with flood insurance? Paint the whole picture for us.
Those are the big questions that we're asking, all the other homeowners that I know of, what do we have to do? You know, where do we start? We have to go to the city. We have to get a permit. But if we do rebuild and if we get the insurance money, another question, and we put the money into our homes, are we going to be insured next year or the year following that? Do we have to raise our houses? And nobody seems to be able to give us a definite answer on that. We don't know where to go.
Well, I want to bring Mr. McIntyre back in, and I realize, Mr. McIntyre, that you represent FEMA and not, you know, the mortgage companies or the flood insurance companies of New Orleans, but I have to say that here we're talking to a citizen who's quite, she's educated and she's quite confused, and when we read the daily newspapers, it seems that, you know, from parish to parish, from city to city, you know, flood insurance rules change, it's construction insurance payments change, it seems to be a huge strata of layers of issues. It's very difficult for the average person to sort out what they're actually going to be entitled to, isn't it? Mr. McIntyre, are you there?
Yes, I am. And as she said, there are lots of frustrations out there for those who are returning to the area and trying to rebuild. For the National Flood Insurance Program, the question of whether she will be insured, the answer is yes, as long as you meet the guidelines for proper elevation or whatever the case may be. the state and local parishes have the building codes that are developed to support the floodplain management program, and whatever is placed into effect will be a part of those building codes. So she needs to stay in contact with them to determine what those codes will be so that they can rebuild properly.
Okay, and Wallace Windsor, is it easy when Mr. McIntyre says you just need to stay in contact with these people? Is it bureaucratic? Is it difficult to keep in contact and get a quick, direct answer right that day?
Absolutely. In fact, I've been to City Hall twice. And each time I go, I walk away more confused than when I went in. The other issue is just getting people to rebuild. You know, you wait 6 weeks to get a contractor to come out to your house to give you a bid. And if you can't give them a check right then and get on the list, you may have to wait another 6 months. So it's a matter of trying to organize everything and get things scheduled. And you really can't even take that first step of rebuilding unless you know what the rules are. And the rules just aren't clear.
What neighborhood are you in?
I'm in what they call Broadmoor.
And where's that?
It's close to Tulane University, but on the other side of Claiborne Avenue. It was zip code 70125. You know, one of the reasons I'm very optimistic, or I'm trying to be optimistic, is that I am very close to Tulane University. I feel that since there's a large institution there, that there's going to be a need for housing, that I should rebuild my apartment, because that's what I'm really talking about, is my apartment. So, you know, that's the hope, that because there's this institution, that I'll be okay. But then there's also a big question of, am I just throwing my money away?
Yeah, and I'm just curious about your neighbors. I mean, what's going on in your neighborhood? You know, we see pictures here at night of New Orleans. I mean, it looks like a ghost town just about. The electricity is not restored. We just mentioned before half the toilets in town are not working with the sewer system.
Right.
I mean, is it feel like a city that's been quite abandoned? Are you pretty much alone in your neighborhood, or is everybody in there?
Pretty much alone. Actually, I haven't stayed at my house overnight. I stay with friends out in the suburbs. I move from place to place. There is electricity in the neighborhood. There are overnight, the lights are on outside. And you can get electricity turned on if you can get an electrician to come over, because your whole house has to be rewired. Every wire that was touched by water has to be rewired. And then you have to go through a process of getting the city to inspect the wiring, and then you have to get Entergy to come turn it on. Now, once you start that process and the rewiring's done, from my understanding, it's anywhere from 2 to 3 weeks to get Entergy to come out and turn the electricity on.
Well, I tell you, when we hear your situation, and evidently you're not one of the worst, I don't mean to undermine what you're going through, but, you know, people have gotten right down to the concrete slab under their homes. There's nothing left.
Right.
You kind of understand why so many thousands of people are still living outside the city and reluctant to come back in. They know what they're going to face.
Absolutely. You know, it's amazing in my neighborhood. There's a variety of people. There are a couple of people actually living there without electricity. There's some houses that have been completely gutted. You can see there's activity. People are moving forward. There are others that are just haven't been touched, and you wonder where those people went. You know, that's what's sort of my marker, is how far am I going to go? Every time I go back to my house, I look to see how many other houses have activity happening in them. Is there construction? And why didn't that landlord come back and fix up his house? There's great, you know, housing there for students in January, and where is that person? Why aren't they back? And that makes me nervous.
Mm-hmm. We can certainly understand why. Thank you very much, Ms. Windsor. I want to bring in Juliana Moray now. Ms. Moray is an architect, actually resident of New Orleans, but living with her family in Mississippi. And besides just her own personal story, she's helping with the casinos down on the Mississippi coast and a number of neighborhoods. Ms. Moray, how are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
Yeah, well, good. You know, so tell us what's happening in your neck of the woods. We sort of have a pretty good picture of New Orleans. What about down on the Gulf Coast?
I wouldn't say that it differs that much, except that we've had a little bit more time. I mean, we benefit from the fact that we were able to get back into our homes fairly quickly after the storm. In fact, most people, you know, one of the traditions is when you leave and you take, you know, a chainsaw with you and you take the things that you're going to need in order to get back in. And because Mississippi, you know, had a different situation immediately after the storm from Louisiana, a lot of people were able to get back in. Now, it doesn't mean the devastation is any less. In fact, there are many areas of Mississippi that have a different kind of devastation in terms of, you know, only having slabs left behind. I think there's a larger number of that situation in Mississippi versus the extreme flooding that New Orleans had. But by and large, people were able to get back in and begin to salvage some of the belongings that might have been left behind and to get the process going, which unfortunately New Orleans did not have that. It was quite a bit of time before people were able to get back in and understand, you know, what they could begin to do.
Yeah, weeks. Ms. Murray, as an architect, you know, what are you finding is the basic issue that people need to now raise their homes higher off the ground for the you know, God forbid, the next onslaught?
Well, that is, you know, something that we're all grappling with. It's a huge question because if you look at the kind of devastation that the storm did, you know, simply raising a home, if you're right on the water, is not really the issue. This storm knocked down, you know, huge houses that were high up, you know, above flood elevations, you know, because it was a 100-year storm. So if your mindset is, am I going to build back and prevent this from happening again, you know, that's not quite the issue. However, one thing to understand about the Mississippi Gulf Coast is that it does have seasonal storms. And what Hurricane Katrina has brought to the fore is that we all have flooding. I mean, my parents' home floods every year from either a tropical storm or some form of a hurricane. And I guess what's happened now is that the devastation is so great that you are asking that question, do I build back? Do I come back and continue to live on this coast? And if so, do I raise up? And some of the interesting architectural strategies that people are thinking about is, number one, yes, I build up higher. And then number two, I think of that first level of living as something that if it gets washed away again, it's okay. And I have a second level that I can occupy. I mean, a lot of people are living in the second story of their homes right now.
Yes. And I understand you've been working on the casinos, and there has been some success. I mean, you know, one of the catch-22s here is for the economy, you know, of all these areas. If people don't come back in, taxes aren't paid, businesses aren't thriving, and the cities are operating on something like a quarter of their usual, you know, revenue. So the casinos are coming back slowly. You've been working with them?
Yes, I've been working with the Beau Rivage Casino and have also, you know, been keeping up in the papers with a lot of the others, and they all have plans to come back. I have not really heard of any of them pulling out. In fact, many of them are thinking about expanding. Of course, they're looking at safety issues. A substantial amount of damage was incurred because of the type of structures that the casino itself sat on. You know, it had to be offshore. And so they're all grappling with, you know, coming onshore or dealing with more secure methods so that kind of damage doesn't happen. But, for example, with the Beau Rivage, they've put together a very strong pitch. They want to be open a year from now, and they want to be fully open. They're going to have all of their services online, and they're very much supporting the Gulf Coast coming back.
All right. Well, listen, I tell you what, Ms. Murray, we have to take a quick break. But when we come back from the break, we've got a couple of scientists and, you know, public health experts who are going to really debate, you know, whether New Orleans itself should be rebuilt. And I wonder if you'd stay with us and join that conversation.
Sure.
Okay. We'll be right back with a little more of To the Point from PRI.
Transcripts of To the Point are available from the Transcription Company, 818-848-6500, or on the web at transcripts.net. A CD copy of To the Point is available by calling 1-800-600-5279.
I'm Diana Nyad, sitting in for Warren Olney today on To the Point. We're taking a look at the desperate situation the people of New Orleans and other Gulf Coast cities are facing almost 3 months after Katrina blasted into their lives. Let's thank James McIntyre first, FEMA spokesman in Baton Rouge, for joining us earlier in the conversation. And turn now to Professor Tim Kusky, who's a professor in the Earth Sciences Department at St. Louis University, author of the 2004 Encyclopedia of Earth Science. Professor Kusky, I saw you on 60 Minutes last night. First of all, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Okay, and I know your basic statement is to say, look, this city, you know, it was improperly designed to be in this particular geographical place to start with, and it's not going to make it in the end, so why not move on up the coast or move on up the state to Baton Rouge or someone else and rebuild what was New Orleans? Can you give us a quick little history lesson? Let's go back to the original building of New Orleans and why it, you know, it really wasn't ideal to build the city there.
Yeah, well, our main point from a scientific point of view is not to say don't rebuild, but how to avoid this catastrophe from happening again.
Okay.
And New Orleans was built kind of in a different kind of geological setting in 1715. And since then, it's been hit by a number of hurricanes. The Mississippi Delta since then has been hit by 62 hurricanes, and about 22 of them have been major storms that have influenced New Orleans in a detrimental way. But the reason that it's becoming more and more hazardous there is because of a combination of natural processes and man-induced processes. The New Orleans area is built on a delta environment. When the Mississippi River flows down, naturally it deposits the mud and the silt at the mouth of the delta and keeps the land restored in that way by every year depositing these thin deposits.
Mm-hmm.
And since New Orleans was founded, we've built these levee systems to protect the city and other surrounding communities all the way up and down the Mississippi from the seasonal floods. But the detrimental effect that those levees have had is that it's taken all of the silt and mud and channels it straight out to the deep waters of the Gulf of Mexico, so the land surface isn't being restored anymore.
I see. And what about the islands? I did notice on 60 Minutes you were showing maps and showing how islands have been, if not completely covered over, they've actually receded, so there's no southern land protection to that area of the coast as well.
Yeah, that's a big problem, and that's one of the places that we could focus some efforts to try to slow down this sinking of the land and the recession of the coastline. Because the whole delta environment has been deprived of this replenishing sand and mud and silt, the coastline's been receding rather rapidly with time. We're losing 25 or 30 square miles. Very frequently we're losing, it's estimated, about almost 3,000 acres per year from the delta environment. If we wanted to fix that or to slow it down, we could do what a lot of people are starting to do now, and there's been many projects proposed, and that's to do some wetland replenishments by letting some of the mud and silt come back out into these coastal marshes. But then that has another effect on the ecosystem, and that the people who are harvesting oysters and other things out there don't really like the fresh water coming out. So it's a mixture of different benefits and risks.
But for those of us lay people, not from the earth science you know, realm, is it just safe to say that New Orleans is sinking? And to build a giant levee system, a huge walled-in city, would put it in peril?
Yeah, it is in peril. New Orleans, parts of it are 10 feet below sea level, surrounded by 15 to 17-foot tall levees. It's sinking at a rate of changes, and the estimates are a little bit varied between different sources at the U.S. Geological Survey, NOAA, NASA, National Geodetic Survey. But basically, up to about a third of an inch a year. Some estimates are about half of that, and it's different from place to place. But the problem is that if we restore the levees to withstand a Category 3 hurricane like they were supposed to before, as time goes on, they're going to continue to sink, and we have to keep on restoring them. And we're going to have to find out you know, which neighborhoods are at the greatest risk and perhaps reconsider whether or not those ones should be rebuilt and find out if there's better places that people could go that would be safer. Because if you're 10 feet below sea level and a storm surge comes in that's 20 feet tall, raising your house by 1 or 2 feet isn't really going to be that helpful if it comes over the seawalls.
No, obviously. Let's turn now to Dr. Ivor van Heerden, who's the director of the Center for the Study of Public Health Impact of Hurricanes at Louisiana State University. That's in Baton Rouge. Dr. van Heerden, thanks for being with us again.
Sure, no problem.
All right, so let's get, you know, sort of your counterpoint to this. That's a pretty negative view, almost impossible to restore the safety of this city, but you're there often. And what do you think? What can be done to protect the city and rebuild it for a potential future disaster like Katrina?
Well, I think offering protection in both the form of levees and restored coastal wetlands will ensure that we can protect New Orleans. And we have a very good example of this. Hurricane Andrew struck Louisiana in 92 as a Category 3 hurricane, and 25 miles inland at a place called Morgan City, we had a 7-foot storm surge. Where Hurricane Andrew crossed, two emerging delta systems that are building as a consequence of diversions of Mississippi flow. So we have these two active, really wonderful, ecologically sound, prograding delta systems. The wetlands in that whole area between in the central part of Louisiana are very, very healthy because of the indirect consequences of the river material. And so between the coast and Morgan City, that hurricane lost 50% of its energy, and that was a straight line track. So if we can at the same time rebuild the levees, get the Mississippi River to do what it used to do. It used to, in the past, it built all of coastal Louisiana. Until the 1930s, we had a net balance between land loss and land gain. We know that we can use that river. It's, in essence, a renewable resource, just like a forest. It floods every year. It carries sediment every year. You know, through a combination of diversions and siphons of different sizes, plus the barrier islands could be readily restored from offshore sand resources that are out in federal waters. There are some sand shoals that represent old former deltas that are high-quality sands. And the state in the past has worked with the Mineral Management Service to secure the rights to mine those. There are ways to mine those sands and rebuild the barrier islands.
Forgive me for interrupting, but so much of what you're talking about are macro solutions, and I don't know, but it sounds to me like they would be decades in the planning and the execution, wouldn't they?
No, it's, you know, if we can go to war in Iraq and if Congress can appropriate $49 billion in a matter of weeks and we can fly everybody over there and start big reconstruction projects, we can do the same here. The bottom line is the will. You know, there are companies right now that are dying to go out and start to work on ship shoal.
Mm-hmm.
They're not going to go rape it. These are companies that know what they're doing. We could start, there are a number of diversions already that are operating at 10% of their capacity. We have some siphons that operate very rarely. If we could get all of these just going, we could have a huge impact.
Professor Kuski, come back and respond a bit of this, would you? I'm trying to picture, you know, the solution that many people have proposed so far is to not that it would be easy in a cultural sense, in a human sense, to abandon New Orleans as one of the great cities of the United States. But what if we rebuilt a New Orleans in, let's say, Baton Rouge, economically, scientifically, would that make more sense?
Well, it's exactly like you say. Socially and economically, we need New Orleans. It is one of America's greatest cities, and our hearts all go out to the people there. Scientifically, the coastline is much more secure up by Baton Rouge. It's not sinking so fast. It's off of the delta environment. And over geological time, the delta has moved quite a few times, around seven major fluctuations in the past 5,000 years and more than 16 or 17 smaller variations. So it turns out that about every 1,000 years, the delta has a major shift where the main channel changes course. And right now, it's wanting to go down the Chafalaya River. It would have done that naturally some time ago if it wasn't for all the engineering works that we've been very successful about keeping in place.
Mm-hmm.
So we have things like we just heard, restoration of the coastal wetlands is very effective at slowing down the storms that are coming in, at slowing down the retreat of the shoreline. We also have to be able to deal with two other effects, one of which we've already addressed in New Orleans. That's groundwater and oil were being extracted from beneath the city of New Orleans and other parts of the delta that were very critical, and that was causing a lot of subsidence. It was like putting a straw into the ground below your feet and sucking out the fluids, and that caused the surface to sink. So that's been stopped, and the rate of subsidence or sinking has drastically lowered. And the other thing that's very important in the area is just organic decay. A lot of the soils are organic rich, and they compact with time. And that's one of the most difficult questions to answer. How do we stop that natural compaction from happening, which is accounting for a lot of the subsidence?
And that's a good point to jump back to. Dr. Van Heerden, a public health impact researcher and expert, let's talk a little bit about the public health issues going on in New Orleans. You're just back from New Orleans a day or two ago, aren't you?
Yeah, I'm actually in New Orleans right now.
Oh, you're there now. Well, what about the issue of the mold, the standing water? I understand the suicide rate has climbed up over the last couple of weeks. You know, what's going on in terms of public health?
Well, you know, there's the issue of the mold. You know, these houses are, when you enter them, they black right up to the ceilings. But worse than that, to some aspects, is the fact that there's 100,000 families who evacuated. They believed in the security of the system. Now they can't come back. Their homes have been destroyed. Many of them didn't have flood insurance because they were retired. They paid off their homes and so on and so on. So these families are now all over the United States. They can't come back. They feel like they've been rejected by the federal government because nobody's stepping in to help them. Their mortgage companies are phoning them and telling them they're going to be sent to collection services and so on and so on. And so they're highly stressed. Their depression levels are going up every day, and we're starting to now see huge numbers going to medical health clinics, but unfortunately some of those are deciding to take the other route. And this is not going to stop until the federal government or somebody steps up to the plate and says, okay, the levees failed. It was catastrophic structural failure. The mechanisms are academic. We need to help these people. We need to guarantee them that they will have homes, that their mortgages will be taken care of, and so on. Because right now, they feel totally rejected, and that's where the worst of the public health impacts are going to be seen.
Hmm. Let's bring in Wallace Windsor now that Dr. Van Heerden's brought up the emotional impact. Ms. Windsor was living in New Orleans, a resident, loves her city, evacuated, and is now back trying to rebuild her home, but it's a slow, arduous process, bureaucratic process. She's described to us already today. And Ms. Windsor, on the emotional end, I'm trying to picture, I'm from New York City. If I one day just people, you know, told me, no, we're just going to abandon in New York City. We're going to just tear it down, abandon it, leave it, and we're going to move up the coast 60 miles and rebuild New York City. You know, you have an emotion. It's your heart. Well, how would you feel if New Orleans was just, we just didn't rebuild it? We moved somewhere else and tried to rebuild Bourbon Street, et cetera. That's
well,
crazy.
It obviously wouldn't work. It obviously wouldn't work. And I agree with Professor Van Heerden. When you go into the city, there's really sort of a sense of desperation, and people are hurrying. It's like they're in a hurry to try to fix it really quickly and pretend like things are okay and things are the way they were, but they're not. I really feel that the federal government does need to address this issue. I know we've been talking about it for decades and decades that I've been there. I've paid attention to it. The coastal restoration, the marshlands. You know, America has a habit or a history of taking from the state of Louisiana and not giving back, and that's how I feel about it. I really feel that if you're going to, you really need to save the city. It's a historic city. It's a cultural city, but you need to do it right, and you need to assure us that it's going to be done the correct way. There's no way that we're going to recreate New Orleans and Baton Rouge. That's just not going to happen.
All right. Juliana Moray is with us today, too, an architect now helping to rebuild the Mississippi coast, both her family's neighborhood and the casinos. But also, Ms. Moray, you have been a resident of New Orleans. When you hear these experts talk about, you know, shoring up the Delta and building up the levees, as an architect, can you picture that happening? Do you think it's realistic to entirely rebuild and safely protect the city of New Orleans?
Well, I honestly can't, you know, comment on it from a scientific point of view. I think that we're going to rely a lot on engineers and scientists to tell us what's possible there. But I do think it is important, you know, just as was stated a minute ago, that there is a moment to pause and understand what the issues are with this and make every attempt that we can to save the city, but make it a safe place. I mean, it's been said numerous times, sometimes you need to save people from themselves. I mean, we don't want to send people back into an environment where we're going to be stuck in this cycle every year. But I think that there is, you know, there's so much love for this city that I think if we put our heads together, we can find good solutions. Maybe not all parts of the city should be inhabited. Maybe, you know, there are areas that we shouldn't go back into, but we need to take the time to identify it and not put a quick fix on it, you know, by any means.
So you're saying there are places with higher ground that would
exactly.
make more sense to rebuild.
To a certain, you know, extent, that study needs to be done to understand where those are, because the other thing that I'll say about New Orleans, I mean, in terms of what I understand of it and from my few visits back there since the storm, is that there are areas that received what we would call typical hurricane damage, you know,
yes.
wind damage, not the substantial catastrophic damage that this flooding caused.
Mm-hmm.
And it would be interesting to look at the city and understand what areas should be, you know, encouraged and remain, you know, and maybe look at other areas that we should not abandon but shift over into other uses, perhaps. You know, maybe people shouldn't be living there, but maybe there are uses that could be there that are non-residential, you know, that still provide some other kind of viability, economic viability to the city.
Professor Tim Kusky, if you'll come back with us, professor of earth sciences at St. Louis University, I've heard you use the metaphor of New Orleans as a fishbowl. If we build up these huge 50-foot-high walls around the city, because the city is right now 10 feet underwater, could go further under if we don't, you know, replenish the deltas, et cetera. We're talking about could you use that metaphor with us a little bit and describe what you mean by this fishbowl?
Yeah, sure. First of all, let me just say that, you know, I have the same point of view as that I've heard from the last couple of people, from Dr. Van Hedren and everybody. We need to look at this as a whole system, and we need to attack it with the strength of the federal government and not try to do small temporary fixes,
mm-hmm.
because hundreds of thousands of lives and livelihoods and the future of one of America's greatest cities is at stake. And so this so-called fishbowl scenario that I outline is what would happen if we don't do anything. With the city sitting now, or good parts of it, 10 feet below sea level, and subsidence are sinking at the rates that I quoted before of about one-third an inch a year, by the turn of the century, the city is going to be sitting offshore. We'll have Lake Pontchartrain on the north, we'll have the Gulf of Mexico on the south and east, and just the very thin levees connecting New Orleans to the mainland. And that would put the city 10 to even 18 feet below sea level. And just imagine, to protect the city from a storm surge that's 20 feet high in that kind of situation, you need very, very, very large flood walls or levees. And those are difficult to maintain, very expensive to continue raising, and they become less stable as they get taller. So that's something that none of us want, but it's something that we need to bring up as a possibility if we continue to do nothing.
I see. Okay, thank you for that. Let's finish up today with Dr. Ivor Van Heerden, who's the director of the Center for Study at Public Health Impact of Hurricanes at LSU in Baton Rouge. Dr. Van Heerden, round things up for us with you. So many of our guests, I guess every single one, has said we've got to do it big scale. The federal government is crucial. What next needs to happen for the federal government to roll up its shirt sleeves and dive up, throw a lot of their resources back at the city of New Orleans?
Well, the most important thing to remember is if these levees hadn't have failed, we wouldn't have this problem.
Mm-hmm.
With a catastrophic structural failure of a levee system that failed even below its design standard. Right now, we could come in and build substantial enough levees to offer most of New Orleans a very substantial level of protection. But we need the federal government to step up to the plate instead of, you know, especially the chief of engineers. He's the nation's engineer. He needs to step up and say, okay, we made a mistake. It didn't work. Let's fix it and let's move forward. The Dutch did it. You know, so can we. The bottom line is this is a federal government problem. It's their levies. And they need to fix it, and they need to fix it soon.
Is that going to happen? Is the chief of engineers going to make that apology and make that plea for money?
I don't know, but, you know, the bottom line is no matter how much the folk wish to have these interagency review panels and all the different studies that are ongoing and are going to take a year The bottom line is it was catastrophic structural failure. Those levees moved laterally, the levee walls, 200-foot sections, moved laterally to the side, 30 feet. You know, that's the problem of New Orleans right now. It's the failure of the levees, not Katrina.
All right, Dr. Van Heerden, thank you very, very much for all of your comments and time today. We also want to thank our other guest, Professor Tim Kusky from St. Louis University, Juliana Moray, Wallace Windsor, and we had with us as well from, I don't have his name in front of me anymore, from James McIntyre, I'm sorry, from FEMA. On Reporter's Notebook, in just a minute, Israel's Prime Minister Ariel Sharon announces he's heading up a new political party, so we'll be right back with more To the Point with that on PRI.
You can find more information on the program, including archived editions, at www.moretothepoint.com. More to the point, all one word, .com.
I'm Diana Nyad, sitting in for Warren Olney, back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. The Prime Minister of Israel, Ariel Sharon, co-founded the Likud Party. But today, Mr. Sharon has announced his plan to quit his party and gather coalition to start a new party with the intent of forcing an election within 90 days. Prime Minister Sharon spoke this way just a few hours ago.
I set up the Likud in order to serve a national idea and to provide hope to the Israeli people. Regrettably, this no longer exists in the Likud. Were I to have stayed in the Likud, I would almost definitely win in the primaries and lead the Likud to success in the elections. That would have been a safer bet on the personal level. But this is not the way to serve the state of Israel.
And that was Prime Minister Sharon, and now joining us is Professor Shmuel Sandler, who's the chair in Democracy and Civility, Department of Political Studies at Bar-Ilan University, which is near Tel Aviv. Thank you very much for being with us, Professor Sandler.
Good evening by us.
Yes, good evening to you. Yes, it is evening, and we thank you for giving us some of your private hour. Listen, let's speak of, the popularity of Prime Minister Sharon. He says he was likely to be elected under the Likud party. Just outline us briefly for us why he needs to move on and form. Is it a broader coalition he seeks?
No, I think he is known as a risk taker, and he, as he said, he's taking a risk by leaving the Likud, where he probably his ticket would have been assured. But he sees himself more as a statesman rather than a politician, and he would like to finish his career as a statesman who changed Israel's borders, maybe gave Israel final borders, and he feels that he can't do it within the Likud, so he's trying to do it by forming a new party.
And that's the, as I understand it, the crucial issue is that when he retires, Prime Minister Sharon, he wants his legacy to be the finite borders of Israel. He wants to set those borders. So who is he trying to gather? Who are his political allies he's trying to gather together for this new party?
Well, he's taking from Likud, he's taking 14 members of parliament, and he's inviting some leading figures in Israeli social, socio-economic, political scene to join him. It's probably going to be an impressive list, but the question still remains whether this will be enough to win a decisive victory.
And he's always been tied to the Likud. This goes all the way back to his co-founding of the party in 1973. Right. Are his politics changing? Or have his colleagues changed within the party to make him want to leave?
His politics changed already for a long time. He sees himself now as a national leader, and as a result, he has moved to the center. And that's, I feel, is not the main issue right now. The main question is, will this move really give him the freedom that he seeks in order to implement his plans, as you said, for definite final borders finite borders for Israel. This is a big question because Israel has always been used to coalition politics, and we never had a party. We never had a government that was a majority government. So this is still a big question.
Yes. We understand that new parties, which I understand are referred to as snap parties, have not historically been very successful, but with the popularity of Mr. Sharon this time around, that might be very different, yes?
Well, that's true what you said, but on the other hand, we never had a prime minister, while he is in office, resigning and forming a party. This we never had before. So maybe we will have something. This time he may succeed. Another factor that can increase his chances is that he has he's in the center. Centrist party, what we know from the polls is that most of the Israelis are in the center. But so far, centrist parties did not do well enough to be the majority party. But this time, maybe Israel changed, and we are more into politics of personalities rather than ideology. So we may have a new turn, a new path here. We have to wait and see.
We will. We'll keep up with you, and we'll keep up with the situation in Israel and Prime Minister Sharon. Thank you so much for your time, Professor Sandler. Today's program was produced by Jonah King with Christian Bordahl and Karen Radziner. The technical director is Mike Newport. You can listen online anytime at moretothepoint.com. I'm Diana Nyad. Join us again for To the Point, produced live as a co-production of KCRW, Santa Monica, and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.
You've been listening to KCRW's To the Point. KCRW offers more than 20 podcasts, including Left, Right, and Center, our provocative, up-to-the-minute, witty confrontation over politics, policy, and popular culture, with Matt Miller, Robert Scheer, Tony Blankley, and Arianna Huffington. Check out the podcast of Left, Right, and Center at kcrw.com.